introduce him on a two shot, I assume.
Yeah.
Yep.
Production funding for Behind the Headlines is made possible in part by the WKNO Production Fund, the WKNO Endowment Fund, and by viewers like you. Thank you.
A look back at the legislative session tonight on Behind the Headlines. I'm Eric Barnes with the Daily Memphian. Thanks for joining us. I am joined tonight by Antonio Parkinson from the State House. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
London Lamar, also from the State House. Thank you for being for the first time.
Thank you.
Along with Bill Drees, reporter with the Daily Memphian. We'll look back at the session as some of the things that happened, things that people know happened, maybe they missed, and what the ramifications and positive and negative and so on of that will be. A couple quick notes. We're taping this because of scheduling issues. We taped this a week ago from when it aired, and we did reach out to all the local Republican House members, and none of them were able to come on. So I'll mention that a couple times in the show. For right now, though, as we sit on Friday, a week ago from when this airs, the Speaker of the House is under fire for association with some text messages and that were misogynistic and that were involved a whole lot of really difficult behavior. And your thoughts on that and whether he may have resigned. The pressure, as we sit here taping this, the pressure is building on him from Republicans and Democrats for him to resign. But I'll go to you first, London. Your first reaction when you saw these texts and you saw, I think there are images, your first reaction.
I was very shocked. You know, throughout the session, I worked really hard to build a strong relationship with the Speaker and had a lot of respect for him, even though we disagreed on a lot of policy issues. So I was very disappointed to see that were some of the conversations he had, not only about with his staff member, but that's how he felt about many Tennesseans. As a Speaker of the House, you're obligated to represent all Tennesseans, no matter if they're a woman or a man or black or white or anything in between. And so we hold our Speaker to higher standards, and to be the third highest elected official in the state, I think it's appalling that he will think those thoughts about many Tennesseans in this state.
As in your interactions with Speaker Quesada, did you, as a woman or as an African-American, did you ever feel sexism? Did you feel prejudice, any of that?
Not in our one-on-one meetings, no. I felt like he respected me as a legislator, as a colleague, as an equal. We may have differed on policy issues, but we were able to respectfully have conversations about our differences. And so it was very disappointing that behind the scenes, those may be some of the thoughts that he had about myself and others. But, you know, I never felt like he showed those to my face. But obviously those text messages were private conversations. And I think that as a Speaker of the House, even whether you push those thoughts in the public or private, you should not think those about many Tennesseans that you represent.
And I assume you believe he should resign?
As of right now, I do believe he should resign. At first, I wanted to give him opportunity to see what action plans he would put out, but I think they're insufficient. And I think that as someone who's the third highest ranking elected official in the state, you should be able to step aside from the speaker position and allow someone who can be more inclusive and can represent all people without any prejudiced thoughts.
Let me go to you, Antonio. Your reactions to it, and you've been London recently elected. You just finished your first session. You've been in there now. Is it 8 years?
8 years.
Eight years. Right. So you've interacted, I assume, with Speaker Quesada when he was, you know, in leadership positions. Mm-hmm. He just ascended into this position. Did you ever experience prejudice or sexism or any of the kinds of things that came out in those text messages? Did you
no,
ever see
no,
that?
No, absolutely not. I've never experienced any of that with Speaker Quesada. Here's the thing for me. One is we can't get lost on the fact of how this all got started. You know, it all got started because of an email that was sent to the district attorney in Davidson County that had a date change on it possible date change on it, and where a young activist that was from Fisk University, it looks like there was some differences between the emails that he had versus the email that was sent to the district attorney, which would have put him back in jail.
Right. And so this was by the chief of staff.
By the chief of staff of Speaker Quesada, and so you know, in all of the things that is happening with the speaker, I think that part of the injustice is being lost, and that story is being lost in all of the speakers' things, which is for me as an African-American House member to see this young man, who I know, being where it appears that he may be being framed, possibly, or someone was making an attempt to have him incarcerated, possibly falsely. I think it's important that people remember why and how we got here. Yeah. Number one. Secondly, in regards to the Speaker Cassidy, look, I didn't elect Speaker Cassidy to the Speaker's office, to the Speaker's position. I didn't elect him to the House of Representatives. You know, it was members of his own party that elected him to the Speaker's position. It was members of his own party that elected him as a House member. And it's going to be members of his own party that either removes him from the Speaker's office or removes him from office. I can say however I want to say, however I feel, but at the end of the day, I didn't vote for him for Speaker, and then I didn't have enough votes to keep him from being the Speaker. So it's interesting to me, the silence is deafening when it comes to members of his own party who actually elected him into that position.
More and more, I mean, to be fair, and I think, you know, you can go online and kind of see either on our site or other people's sites, some of the people, Republicans, who are coming out saying either disapproval or outright he should resign. I think the governor and the lieutenant governor both said, you know, sort of couched their phrases as, if he were on my staff, I would want him to resign, that sort of paraphrasing. So just to be fair.
Right.
And again, let me repeat that we asked Republican members of the Shelby delegation to be here today, and they couldn't.
Right. And you know, still, at the end of the day, you had the Speaker of the Senate and you had the governor who said some veiled comments and nothing direct as to what should happen with him. And but that's only a few out of, what, 66 members or 65 members that could have said something. And let me be clear on this also. When all of the issues of race and misogyny and all of those things came forth in these text messages, where were the members of his party that stand on their Christian faith? Every time you're in the House, you know, pushing Bible verses and this, that, and other, where were they in defense of some of these allegations of race, some of these allegations of sexism and things of that nature? And so, you know, I believe that it should be pushed back on the people who put him in that office.
Procedurally, and then I'll get Bill in here, or maybe Bill, you help me. Mm-hmm. Procedurally, the session is ended. So the session to vote him out, it would have to, the session, they'd have to call a special session. Is that correct? Am I right on that?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And then, so he could resign now. I mean, just it'd be more symbolically, because generally the speakership ends technically at the end of the session, and he would be most likely reelected, had this not happened, when the session opens again.
But that's the end of a 2-year.
Is that okay? The end of the 2-year. So he is still Speaker. I mean, he is still Speaker throughout. Okay. Right. And there's a lot of work that's done in the sort of the off season, right? When you're not in session, there are meetings and there are things going on.
There is, and it would take a 2/3 call from the membership to call a special session, or the governor can call a special session.
Yeah.
And Antonio, to your point, if this plays out that Speaker Cassidy leaves, however he leaves, is there a discussion between Democrats and Republicans, a kind of a reckoning over this that goes beyond him then? Yeah.
And you're talking about in regards of his replacement?
No, I mean in regards to his comments and what you called the deafening silence.
Well, there should be a discussion between Democrats and Republicans right now.
Absolutely.
You know, in regards to the things that have been said, but there has not been. And, you know, you have a bunch of different silos of people speaking in regards to this matter, but you're not hearing it from his party. The majority of his party. Now think about it, there have been some that have come out and said something, but those are people that didn't vote for him for Speaker anyway. And so where are the people that will stand up and grow a set and speak out for what's right?
And I think for me, what's most appalling is the fact that those who have spoken now have been they've spoken out after the allegation of sexual misconduct have come out. But when we were talking about the racial issues, about them using the N-word, about them framing a black activist, there was silence. And so I've started my term being able to call out some of the issues of racism among my colleagues, because we know that is a problem. And their silence about the issues of racism that our speaker talked about, to me, is confirms some of the thoughts of some of my colleagues. They do agree with some of the things that he said. And sometimes when you are silent, that means you agree with what he's doing as well. If we want to be bold in our approach, if we truly want to represent all Tennesseans, then we need to speak out on the first instance of injustice. And when we talk about racism, when we talk about calling black people idiots, many of us are your colleagues who are African-American. And I think that we're all smart and intellectual. And
let me reframe the question I asked before to a broader, you know, there are a lot of divides in the legislature, you know, Republican and Democrat, rural and urban, I mean, you know, and the and so on. Have you felt, and you've been there longer, I mean, from anyone, do you feel racism or do you feel prejudice from your colleagues up there, explicitly or implicitly?
Let me be clear. And I've been on record on the House floor of talking about policy that was racist. And when they were taking the money from Memphis because of the removal of the Confederate statues, I got booed on the House floor because of that. But let me say this, though, and I don't want this to be lost on what my young colleague said just a second ago. When she made her comments on live, they raked her across the coals about what she was saying. Now you have, you know, these words that are in text from his chief of staff, and no one from that party that raked her across the coals are saying anything about it.
I don't know why I'm focused up, but I just want to for a second. Have you felt that, not so much on the policy and interpreting a policy as race, and that we can debate and discuss, but I mean, just have you felt that personally, in personal interaction?
I'll defer to the young lady and I'll come back behind her.
You know, I have, I feel, you know, you can feel when someone doesn't respect the comments that you have, you know, are disrespectful in their responses to your questions, laugh at you when you are bringing up points about how particular policy affects my community, which is predominantly African-American, which I have an obligation to speak up for and stand up for. So yes, it's there. You can feel it. You can feel it when you walk down the hallways. Now, they may not call me out my name to my face because, right, you know, that's not something I'm sure will be allowed. But at the end of the day, you know, it's there. And whether it's inadvertently or, you know, out in the open, it's something that's real.
There's also, and I will say this just more from the perspective of being up over the last 10 or 15 years at the Capitol for any kind of news reasons and also, you know, press association reasons, there's a tremendous antipathy towards Memphis.
Absolutely.
You know, so I walk up there as a 50-year-old white guy, and I look like, you know, a lot of these rural legislators, and I'll say I'm from Memphis, and they'll say I'm sorry. And right, this happens again, and this is a story that people who don't know the legislature know that dynamic is this very, it's less than it used to be, believe it or not, I think.
No.
But it's very real that there is this antipathy towards Memphis among legislators.
Absolutely.
Up there that transcends race and gender. And I'm not taking away from what you said.
Absolutely.
But it's an interesting dynamic.
And it has not, it's still the same. It's still the same, just the same as it was before. You know,
and you obviously are there much, much more than me. So
right,
I defer
right,
to you.
Right. And you know, the amount of disrespect towards the city that contributes probably the majority of the resources to the state coffers.
Absolutely.
Is to me is unacceptable. And last year or year before I joked with the idea of secession from Davidson County to the Mississippi River. But, you know, you think about it, and I just wanted people to think about that. You know, you have the two biggest contributors to the state coffers, and both of them are disrespected. Memphis more than Davidson, right? But people
from Nashville say the same thing.
Right,
I mean, absolutely.
Right. But if you took those away, this would probably be the poorest state in the union.
Yeah.
You know, and so that matters.
Halfway through the show, and let me also again reiterate for people coming late, we did ask Republicans, local House Republican members to be here, and we were not able to get any on the bill.
So among the other fireworks late in the session was something that happened on the last day, and that was Democrats were leaving the chamber, and there was an attempt to stop Democrats from leaving the chamber. My question is, what does this bode for the future? Is it possible that given the emotion that's there right now that could be there at the start, the reaction to proposals going through a majority Republican legislature, are walkouts a possibility in your chamber?
Well, see, so that, you have to frame that in the moment that it happened. Mm-hmm. In the moment, there's a couple of different dynamics happening. One, we were actually in a recess. And so anybody could walk out in a recess. But now let's go back just a little bit more in time before that. A lot of the Republican members had gone home because they weren't staying for the last day of session. So we're in a recess. A lot of their members have gone. Right. And we decide, because they were silencing Democrats in regards to health care, that we're going to go and huddle together and talk about it in the recess. Well, when we decided to go and huddle about it, I think the speaker saw that, you know, he might possibly not have a quorum to finish the business. And so that's when the call was made to lock the doors, secure the doors, and keep everyone on the inside. But by that time, you got bodies in between the double doors, legs sticking out on one end, I think troopers pushing in on the outside, and Democrats pushing out, and security trying to hold Democrats in, and, you know, bodies start rolling up the aisle, you know. So that's kind of what happened there. You know, whether or not, you know, we fight. That's what we do. In the House, we fight. Senate is a little bit different. You know, it's not as lively as the dysfunctional House is. And it's in some aspect of family, a dysfunctional one at that. But
well,
we fight.
A larger family at 99 members and 33.
99 boisterous members. right. Energetic members.
Who are all elected.
Mm-hmm. May have had some coffee and they're raring to go. And so, you know, so the House, you know, you got to love the House. It's a very interesting dynamic.
So it was kind of a convergence of factors that no one planned. But does it raise the possibility of using a walkout as a tool, given that whoever is the speaker needs three Democrats in order to maintain a quorum?
No. Let me tell you why.
Okay.
Because it takes 50 votes to pass something on the House floor. Okay, if you remove 34 of us, if you remove our twenty-six of us,
right,
they still have enough to pass anything they want to pass. And so, and that's one of the things that is lost on me. You know, you have the numbers to do what you want to do. So you can be the hero at every turn, honestly, if you're in the majority, because you have the numbers to do. If we didn't have Republican allies in some issues, on some issues, they could just run roughshod over the whole session. And
where are those? Where looking back, I mean, try to be more positive for a minute. I mean, where you had to have worked with some Republicans, some local or in other states. What are some examples? I mean, it's not all this hostility. We because of what happened with Speaker Quesada and some of these other things, that's where we started today.
But
there are other points at which things did get done. I mean, we have items, you know, $10 million for the riverfront. There were some things that got done that took, and I imagine, involved some back and forth and cooperation.
Absolutely. I think a great example of that is even though it passed, the voucher vote, there were both Democrats and Republicans who were opposing this particular piece of legislation. And matter of fact, before the speaker flexed his power and held the vote, the vote was failing. The more Republicans helped us defeat this bill until there were some conversations to swing another Republican over. But even on simple education bills about, you know, protecting our public schools, you see Republicans and Democrats on the same page working together. There was a bill about, you know, recalling school board members where both Republicans and Democrats had concerns about what precedents we would set if we were able to recall school board members for any reason. And there are a number of bills and legislation we can point to show that we're working together. And quite honestly, the majority of legislation, both Democrats and Republicans vote together on all the time. Yeah. And so a lot of times what you see on TV is the bills where we're fighting against each other, when we're on opposite sides, where we're going at each other's heads. But the majority of the time you see it's a consensus green light on the board. And you know, despite, you know, our difficulties and our difference of opinions, if we always keep the fact that we're working for all people at the forefront of how we vote in our legislation, then I think that we have more alikes than differences.
Bill.
As we're recording this, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation has acknowledged that it is investigating some of the trades that were being made for votes on the school voucher bill.
Absolutely.
The deciding vote, as it turns out, voted for it after, and he was very open about this, after Knoxville, the area that he represents, came out of the voucher bill. Is that kind of deal making, it should that be the object of a criminal investigation?
I'll go ahead and pass it on to you. First of all, absolutely. I think that to hold the vote for 40 minutes and then be calling people, and some of these folks, you heard him calling up to the well on the mic, or taking them out to the balcony and having conversations about changing their votes. We obviously know if someone was very firm on a no, and then you have a conversation with them and they turn to yes, there's some discrepancies there that we need to think to talk about. For us, it is very out in the open and abuse of power. And if, you know, citizens are explaining that they don't want something and you're pushing, threatening chairmanships or whatever that may be in order to change their vote, that's unacceptable. And it's also offensive, especially when it comes to this voucher vote, to say that, well, if it's not good for my county, then, you know, it's okay that we put it on Shelby County and Davidson County, even though you're saying we don't want it in ours, but then their kids need it. And that's problematic to me, because as legislators, even though we represent our own districts, we have an obligation to think about all Tennesseans, because the legislation that we pass typically affects all Tennesseans. So to hear our legislators say, well, I'm only going to pass this bill because it's going to mess up Shelby County or Davidson County schools, to me is problematic. And so for the speaker to push that, and his Republican colleagues to push that, for the governor to push that, it to me is offensive. And I think what it does is open the doors to tell you that some things are going on that's not right, the deals are being made, and that if you're going to vote for something just because it affects one particular population of kids and not yours, that in itself is criminal.
Well, I don't know about criminal, you know, but if something was given in exchange, something probably tangible was given in exchange for a vote change, that could be the criminal part of it. Now, if you're adjusting legislation to accommodate a member or some members, that's just like making an amendment to the bill. So that's normal. That's normal practice. But here's the thing, you know, my colleague, Representative Zachary, said
he's the representative from Knoxville
who switched the vote. He said that they took Knoxville out of it, so that's what gave him the go ahead to cast a vote. Well, here's the problem with that statement. If he'd have voted no, Knoxville wouldn't have been in the bill. Mm-hmm. And so the bill would have died. So Knoxville or anyone else wouldn't have been in the bill. So I don't really subscribe to his reasoning for casting their vote. And lastly, let me make this point too. And the reports that I've heard is not TBI that's investigating this, FBI, the feds that are investigating this deal. So, you know, either one is bad to me. And I wouldn't wish that on any of my colleagues to be under investigation by either TBI or FBI.
And this goes back to, we were talking before about the various divisions, and you know, it's really only Davidson County and Shelby County that are subject to if we didn't make that clear. Mm-hmm. With just a couple minutes left, let me walk through a couple of just real nitty bills that got through, that got a lot of attention. We talked about the vouchers and where that's going. Online gambling that passed, that so now there'll be sports betting allowed on phones and computers and so on within Tennessee. I think both of y'all were in favor of that.
Right.
What do you want to see come from that? And do you want that to be the first step towards full-blown legalized gambling in Shelby County?
I voted for and support because I think with heavy regulation, it's happening anyway. And I would rather Tennessee be able to use some of those dollars that come from gambling to support education and other initiatives that help our community. You know, you see a lot of our citizens aren't engaged in gambling. They're either taking their dollars across the bridge to Arkansas or down the road to Tunica, Mississippi. And I would rather our dollars stay in our state. And so that was why I supported the bill.
Will you support further expansion? I mean, brick and mortar, they say, you know, casinos in Tennessee, Shelby County. Would you support that sort of bill?
I'm open to it.
With just a couple minutes left, another bill that passed was expungements. The $180 expungement fee was removed. It's a criminal justice issue that actually, I think more and more Democrats and Republicans are coming together on some of those issues. Talk about that expungement.
Well, just real quick, I know we're short on time. First of all, you know, the our Republican colleagues had gotten the marching instructions from some of their people who give them marching instructions, some of the organizations, to incarcerate everybody. And so mass incarceration was going on, and now it's busted the coffers of the budgets. So now they've changed face and say, hey, we shouldn't be incarcerating everyone. So let's find a way to keep people out of the prison.
And some would say, to be fair, because we don't have a many would say it's not just the budget, it's also a realization that it's wrong, and a lot of people goes back to their Christian faith and forgiveness and so on. So just to push back a little bit on that, it's not just about money.
They were Christians before that.
And
it didn't become a conversation. Honestly, in my 8 years, I've been fighting for criminal justice reform since day one. In my 8 years, it did not become a conversation until it became a budgetary issue. And it's unfortunate, but we're looking at it from a humanitarian standpoint. They're looking at it from a fiscal standpoint. I don't care what their reason for looking at it is. Let's get it done. We got this $180 off of there, but there's still fees locally, you know, that people have to do. So.
All right. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you both for being here. Thank you, Bill. And thank you for joining us. Join us again next week.